find myself lying dead as a babe within outstretched hands. I find myself in the western land asking for bread from this honest man. Until not here. Be brought to your father's land, and my cross alone goes to an ancient man to return to his promised land. Oh, it holds yet out of his lying den. Myself in the western train, here I am back again, winding around this lonesome bend as a stranger in a foreign land, singing, do not fear the lion.
Yes, blessed to do not fear the lion's den, because we're blessed to be alive and staying alive with the blessings of the Creator in Torah Chaim, instructions of life toward Chesed, instructions of kindness toward Rachamim, instructions of mercies. We're now broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we're the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We call it from Soul Class to Soul Class. 596, Secular by Design Program, presentation number 63. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live at 9:32 a.m. on April 13, 2016, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA. Unified Soul Actualization Program content. We'll focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a philosophy of no hide laws and observances, which can be purchased via various linkages on the net. Just type in Alan W. Cecil, C-E-C-I-L, Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances. Our call number is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances. Children of Israel and children of Noah collaborating to end hate, jealousy, and competition, which is not necessary. Last but not least, seven Noahide commandments plus 613 commandments equal the crown of the eternal Torah, because in the Torah's Gematria, 7 plus 613 adds up to the Hebrew word Chaf, Tav, Resh, which equals 620. And we just heard now Levi Robbins, a bright, beautiful young man, from his CD, which is called Levi Robbins. That was Lion's Den. And let's now segue quickly into our program. Let's introduce our host. We have author of Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances, Alan W. Cecil. Take it away, Alan.
Hey, good morning, Alan. How are you doing today?
Well, for fast relief, I suggest everyone get to their local internet linkage and get Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and also and observances. And also joining us, a man who's always trying, because I know he's not lying, the Lion of the Dispersion Dissemination Teaching of Rambam, Nesher Gadol, the Great Eagle, Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, everybody.
And maybe everyone can detect that I'm a little charged up. That's what happens. You can combine chia with spaghetti with spicy peppers and a nice cup of coffee. That was my breakfast. Gentlemen and blessed souls out there, before we get into the meat of today's presentation, I want to dedicate today's program to the Refuah Shleimah, the complete healing of my father, Reb Shlomo Yaakov Shiyichia ben Esther, Aleih Shalom. My father is languishing in pain, unfortunately. In fact, he started taking morphine treatments to alleviate the pain. May the Rofei Kol Basar, may the healer of flesh heal him, and may he be restored to his vim and vigor that can be expected of a man who just turned 85 according to the solar calendar year, and also for the strength and spirit and soul and body of my mother, Maras Yiska Techia Bas Chayasar Elisham. Chayasar was my grandmother, my mother's mother. So without further ado, blessed souls, we're going to go back about 1,946 years. Can you imagine in your mind, there's not an America, there's not a European Union, There's not a Vatican. There's not anything that we know of, except there's the destruction of the temple in 69 Common Era. And what? And as out, we go into page 123 of the Protocols of the Historian from Ellen's book. And Trajan decided to follow Alexander the Great and invade the Middle East and possible India. So empire back then was the empire of Rome, which was not depending on European opinion or the West's opinion or the Asian opinion. They was going out and creating a lot of, as we say in Hebrew or Russian, balagan, a lot of confusion and a lot of bloodshed. As the Roman legions marched into Mesopotamia, the Jewish people living in Parthia rebelled. Although many of these Jews did not experience the disastrous war in Judea, they were nevertheless affected by the destruction of Jerusalem. As Trajan emptied lands into the East Mediterranean region, the long-suffering Jews revolted in Cyprus, Cyrene, and in Egypt. Trajan's conquest of Parthia was put on hold as he made his general Turbo turn back to deal with the revolt. The Romans were ultimately successful in quashing this uprising, but at a terrible cost. This revolt marked the end of Roman expansion, and from then on, the frontiers of the Roman Empire would slowly and steadily shrink. For the Jews, however, it was another disaster. The Jewish populations in Cyrene and Egypt were decimated, and the Jewish population in Cyprus was exterminated entirely. It should go without saying that Gibbon's account of the Jews, quote-unquote, devouring flesh and licking up blood was an exaggeration. Yet this was the stigma that attached to the Jews, the quote-unquote, the blood libel that was popular in the Middle Ages, that the Jews required Christian blood, usually from a child, to make their matzahs for Passover. I just want to point out, and I'll turn to Alan and Dennis. First of all, blessed souls, we have a strict biblical injunction not to drink blood. In fact, that can cause spiritual excision, the death of the soul as we know of it. Don't ask me to explain what that means. But basically, a Jewish person, man or woman, who consciously were to eat blood, or to drink it, I guess, to imbibe of it, whatever, to mix it into their food, or the matzahs, I guess. And by the way, this is something that's still going on today in the Middle East. Unfortunately, we have some our cousins, some of the Muslims, I'm not saying all of them, but some of them are still conjuring up this blood libel. And the ironic thing is this: to accuse us of using the blood of a child to make our matzahs is so the opposite of what the matzahs stand for, which is humility and an expression of freedom. A person is not expressing their humility by killing another human being for their blood, and number two, that it's not an expression of freedom, it's being enchained to another form of spiritual, cognitive, emotional slavery. So, Alan, we read from last week Gibbon's bias against the Jews, but here we see the distortion is just so overwhelming. I mean, I kind of like rattle my head. It's like, you know, what did this guy put in his pipe to smoke when he's saying we were the ones licking the blood when we were getting slaughtered 1,946 years ago? Alan? I guess
well,
I looked out. Dennis?
Okay.
Go ahead,
Dennis.
Alan.
Go, Dennis.
Well, we have throughout history all sorts of things that humans do. Some of them are unbelievable, but they go ahead and do them anyway. Stories are exaggerated, but people want to hear a little something extra, a little exotic, because the regular stuff is too mundane. In the 60s, when I was in the South, I actually heard people and I interviewed people who belong to a certain Christian sect. I don't want to say on the radio, but they believe Catholics were still eating their babies.
And what?
No, this is the guy who actually believed it. Why? Because their minister told them that, so they believed it. So here we have people who are in position that should, I would think, and you would think, would know better. But they're repeating these stories, and what happens is, if enough people repeat it, well, it must be true, of course. So throughout history, we have people who retell a story, and other people repeat it. But that's human nature, and this goes on all the time. We call it exaggeration, because we can't handle the truth.
Dennis, thank you. Alan?
Yeah, well, these are the Romans who said these things. The Romans who like to take condemned people, cut off their noses, sew them in a bag with a wild animal, and throw it in the river. You know, for them to talk about things like that is beyond absurd. As you pointed out, for Jews to have some ritual where they're drinking blood is just so preposterous, it's laughable. And what's not laughable is so many people believe it.
Yep, unfortunately.
Well, Don, that's the whole idea of to discredit anybody, you start a rumor. And those rumors just pick up, and they gain wings, and they keep flying all over the place. And we can see historians repeating the rumor, but they're afraid to say it was a rumor.
Thank you, Dennis. Going further into page 124, in the section called Protocols of the Historian by Alan W. Cecil, the treatment of the Jews contrasts greatly to Gibbon's treatment of the Romans. As Michael Parenti points out, and Michael Parenti authored The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, published by New York Press, 2003. You're going to be quoting from page 16 now from that book. That Gibbon's accounts of Rome reveal, quote, not a word here about an empire built upon sacked towns, shattered armies, slaughtered villagers, raped women, enslaved prisoners, plundered lands, burned crops, and mercilessly overtaxed populations. Gibbon was a member, as Alan records for us, was a member of the elite upper class, as were many other classical historians. And from there, we quickly turn to page 17 and 18 of Parenti's The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, pages 17 and 18, where Alan quotes Parenti as he wrote, antiquity gives us numerous gentlemen chroniclers, Homer, Herodotus, Thucydides, Polybius, Cicero, Livy, Plutarch, Suetonius, Appian, Dio Cassius, Valerius Maximus, Velius Paterculus, Josephus, and Tacitus, just about all of whom had pronounced a low opinion, just about all of whom had a pronounced low opinion of the common people. Gibbon's view of history was not only that of all 18th century English gentlemen, but of a whole line of gentlemen historians from bygone eras, similarly situated in the upper strata of their respective societies. And therefore, going back to before footnote 20, Gibbon was a member of the elite upper class, as were many other classical historians. And his values were reflected in his historical outlook. So Alan continues, when we understand that so much of our quote-unquote history has been distorted through the lens of class, culture, and Christianity, we can put into perspective the comments of Kant's statement that it was only through Greek history, the history of quote-unquote the enlightened and quote-unquote educated public, that the protocols of the Edomite historian were to downplay the role of Israel and to highlight the role of Greece and Rome. Going further, when we look at a map of the Western world, we notice two tiny specks representing the cities of Athens and Jerusalem. As Solomon Grazel put in Grazel's History of the Jews, page 2, it is astonishing to realize that the culture of all the rest of the map is based on the contributions made by these two spots. Although our culture is a synthesis of teachings and legacy of those two cities, we clearly favor the Greeks, and it is the Greek conception of history that concerns us. What is the value of classical education, and education limited to Greek and Roman studies? There is no argument that there are many things in classical Greek and Roman culture that are worthy of study, and I would acknowledge that as well. But there are also some serious shortcomings and limits to what classical education can teach, particularly in the areas of morality and social structure. Our intellectual society has expended a tremendous amount of energy keeping Torah out of the Torah consciousness and the academic dialogue. What can the Torah teach us about our society and to how to cure our social ills? How can our affinity of intellectual be expended into one who incorporates the Torah into framework and foundation for knowledge? Western society has modeled itself on the binary structure of secularism and religion, both of which are limited to the paradigm of Greek and Roman thought. our educational, political, and economic system, in short, our entire culture conforms to the culture of ancient Greece and Rome. Quote unquote, Europe and the United States, after all, have a dual heritage, Judeo-Christian religion and ethics, Greco-Roman statecraft and law. And it's quoting from Morris Berkman's Dark Ages America, The Final Phases of Empire, quoted by, published in New York by W.W. Norton and Company, 2006, page 88. The problem with this view is that, quote unquote, there is little that is Judaic about Christian theology. And the term Judeo-Christian was developed in the earliest 20th century, implying a continuance or at the least a shared set of values of the Judaic tradition in Christianity. And that's Alan quoting from his Noahide Code in the Academy of Shem Press, which Alan so graciously sent me. And I want to tell you about this. One day when we finish this book, we'll move on to reading from that book with Alan's permission, of course. The underpinnings of Christian theology came from the same Greco-Roman sources as our secular classical knowledge. There are two branches of the same tree rooted firmly in the soil of ancient Greece and Rome. Before I turn to Dennis and Alan for feedback, I just want to mention, it does strike me, although I grew up thinking we live in a Judeo-Christian society here in America, I can acknowledge that, but when I think back historically, say 300 years ago, 500 years, or 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, I don't know if the Christian powers that be would have embraced that term, Judeo-Christian. And Jews might have been very have many trepidations of being saying they're part of a Judeo-Christian society for fear of arousing the ire and the anger and continuous prosecution that was rampant in the early stages of the European history up until say like the last 300 years. Dennis, your take on these matters?
Well, to say that you're going to separate the hyphenated word Judeo-Christian is going a little too far. What happens is Christianity began at a Judaism. The problem is when the Greeks came along, they centered everything on the human brain, personalized human brain, and they said that was the center of our existence, was our brain. However, when it came to religion, we all understood that their religion was a myth. And they had mythology. All their gods were mythological. Same thing with the Romans. So we sort of treated that as comic or comic book type of stuff, that's where the religion is in the myth. So there was no serious thinking about spiritual things as it emanated from the Greeks. Because everybody else in the Western culture said, oh, well, they had the smartest brains, but they didn't really get into religion because that was all mythological. So here we have a distortion of the worst type, and that is it took us away from concentrating on the entire universe, and it centered on the human brain and partially excluded anything spiritual. And that was absorbed by the Western cultures over the years. But where the sources began and who emanated from what, I don't care. You cannot rewrite history. It's already been written.
True. Alan?
Well, you know, look at the early church and the writings that we have of the early New Testament are all in Greek. The language of the Catholic Church is, the official language is Latin, the Roman language. It's hard to say. Even religion has its background. It's based on Greek and Roman thought. And you look at some of the famous Christian theologians of history, such as Augustine of Hippo, who introduced a Neo-Platonism into his theology. You know, there's just so much of the Greek thought in Christianity, Greek and Roman philosophy, thought, language. There's very little that's really Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Alan. Now let's go further. Alan's going to make some clarifications here. And we talked about this, if not on the previous program, in previous programs before that, And this is at the bottom of page 125, the section Protocols of the Historian from Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noah Hedlos and Observances. If you're just joining us, Blitzos, wherever you are in this blessed world, the Torah is not primarily a book about history. The Torah is a book of law. Here, Alan outsourced from the Stone Chumash, put together by Rabbi Nassim Sherman, Brooklyn, Masor Publications, 1994, page 192. It is fundamental to proper understanding of the scriptural narratives that the Torah is not a history book and that whatever it records must have a halachic or moral purpose. And that's a very important point there because, again, the Torah can mean basically, if you translate from the Hebrew to the English, it means instruction and it also means law. It also has been given, has been allegorized, it's called as a song as well. But that's an expression of ecstatic expression that was prophetically written in the Torah and also mentioned numerous times throughout the Tanakh. Often the Torah will talk about events that are out of sync with a linear timeline, such as telling us the depths of men such as Noah and Terach when their part in the Torah is finished, then speaking of events that occurred while they were still alive. This is a peculiarity of the Torah and is to teach us that there is something to be learned that is more important than simply a strict historical narrative. A very excellent point Alan's bringing out here. This is not to say that the Torah is ahistorical, and some might even put it's only allegorical, heaven forbid. There's a realm that's allegorical, but that's only one of many dimensions of the Torah. But the history in the Torah is concerned with teaching morality and values, mores, and values often different from those taught by the Greek and Roman histories. Unlike other ancient literature, the Torah often focuses on the mistakes, even by its greatest men and women, showing the consequences of their action. And that is so true. Because even by the most righteous, we learned about the mistakes made by King David and Moses, and Solomon admitted to making mistakes, and Samuel the prophet was shown to have made a mistake. Jacob was held accountable at a certain level for the way he approached his brother. And also there was a peace treaty that Abraham made with Avimelech, that also from the Old Torah tradition that our sages with the divine the Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, instructed us that the way that he went about it was not proper, and it actually brought the Jews, the Israelites, the Hebrews, eventually into a severe test, which is known as the exile, the initial exile in Egypt. So I'll turn to Dennis for some feedback, comments, and concerns, and then Alan.
Well, the first question I have is the book of Genesis history or law? And that's disturbing when you say there is no history in the Bible or any of Scripture. Yet it's the first written word that we're supposed to believe in as to what transpired when the world began and humans started populating the earth. It's hard for me to see that it's law-based when it's a historical document that has no comparison. In other words, there is no other document that tells a different story. Isn't Genesis really history? Now, it may have law added. Maybe it's a combination of both. That I can accept. But to say there's no history in it is a little hard to take, Don.
Well, then before Alan responds, if I said that there is history, and Alan asserted as well, it is not primarily a book about history. The book of Genesis, yes, from every part of the book of Genesis, laws can be learned out, but the laws are learned out from the context of the history because there was a sequence of events, and a sequence of events can be otherwise be described as the history of events. So if I read it wrong, no, the Torah definitely has history in it, but the history is for the sake of the instruction that we should glean out of it. So that's how I want to respond. Ellen, would you like to make your point, agreeing, disagreeing, or bring another point that Dennis and I didn't bring up?
Well, as I brought it out in the book, it is historical, but it is not history as we have come to know it, you know, in a
right,
precise chronological order. You know, for instance, the events in Genesis 15 occurred before the events in Genesis 12. And you have to take those sort of things into account. It's not meant to be a precise historical document as far as, well, this happened first and then this happened next. Because sometimes it does, because of the narrative, because of the moral and legal lessons that it's wanting to teach, gives accounts maybe not in exact chronological order. The accounts happen, they happen around that time, but that's what the rabbis talk about.
Right. I'd just like to add, and then we can also turn back to Dennis for more feedback, comments, or concerns, that there is a book called Seder Olam. It's in Hebrew. I don't know if it's been translated in English. It means the order of the world, meaning, again, the sequence of events as this creation is basically bound up, according to the Kriya as well, as a series of cause and effect relationships. So the book of Genesis explains to us the initial set of cause and effect relationships sequenced in a certain fashion. But again, the thing is, what do we learn out from this sequence of events, from the first 6 days of creation and then Adam and Eve and the problems they had in the Garden of Eden leading to their expulsion? I mean, there is something, it's not just a narrative as a narrative unto its own. It's a narrative with an instruction that hopefully we, 5,776 years later, will learn from their mistakes, and their bad behavior we won't emulate, and their good behavior we will emulate. Dennis?
Well, I rather hear the story of Genesis than have some scientists explain to me their version of what happened in the Big Bang or when the Earth was created, etc. In other words, from a human viewpoint and a spiritual viewpoint, Genesis has the glue of where you should start from. Not from the empirical viewpoint of scientists. It is the word. The Bible is the word. It is not someone's impression. It is not someone's idea that they put into words. It's a formulation of the word. And we don't have something better than the Bible to read to understand what happened.
Sure. And I, if one wants to, there is Josephus Flavius, who I was talking with someone yesterday, someone who is a learned Torah observant Jew, and he was saying, if you want to get the flavor of the history, say, right, you know, we started today's program talking about 70, the year 70 in the Common Era, that you can there, you can go online. I think you have in PDF files, or you can even buy the books. If, in fact, you want to get some sort of historical narrative, which is not necessarily a Torah law, Torah law embedded type of instruction, you can go to Josephus Flavius, who many of the sages of Israel are relying on for his quote-unquote historical portrayal of those events, and he also gives a recapitulation from the beginning of creation up until the what he called, he has a one of his works is called The War of the Jews, meaning how did we deal with the Roman Empire. I just wanted to throw that in there. We're going to read one last section. Yeah, yeah.
You're talking about Josephus.
Josephus, yes.
So, well, Josephus changed his name after the temple in the year 70 was knocked down, and he became a friend of the Roman court. And to do that, he had to change his last name to the emperor's family name. So when you see Flavius, that's because he changed it because he became Romanized. But he is more important and honored and noted by all types of historians prior to becoming a name changer and worked for the Romans as a PR person. But up until then, he is considered the most accurate historian in the history of the world.
I agree. Alan, any take on Josephus Flavius or if people want to get a historical narrative outside of the Greek Greco-Roman perspective, do you have any ancient authors you'd like to recommend?
not really, unless you want to talk about Sun Ra, the Chinese writer. I don't know. There's not really anything. Josephus has a lot of interesting stuff. It is the only really historical account of the end of the Second Temple period. Yeah, it's been he wrote to appease his Roman audience, but there's still a lot in there if you really want to dig that you can learn about.
Sure.
One thing I would like to mention is, you know, in the beginning of the first overview, back around page 40, you know, I discussed this thing with the history of Genesis and that matches what the scientists actually say, how the universe was created.
True, that's true. And I was going to say, I recall from learning very superficially, but I still recall from a Kabbalistic viewpoint, there are certain points in the Big Bang which could not necessarily in contradiction with the viewpoints of, you know, the secrets of the Torah, but I'm not really someone who goes so much into that. I'm more concerned about, you know, social justice and trying to bring this dialogue out, and of course promoting the Seven Noahic Commandments and the 613 Commandments for we Jewish people. But let's now read the final section. Well, it's not the final section, the final section for today's program. The protocols of the historian resulted in downplaying the role of Israel in Western civilization to the point where the Jews were presented as fossilized archaic culture whose only contribution was to write the preamble to the New Testament. This resulted not only in how intellectuals viewed theology, but history as well. It is perhaps fitting that the hedonistic ideal of Greece was represented in the person of Alexander the Great, who enjoyed a Sodomic and Bacchanalian lifestyle as he spread Greek culture throughout the Middle East from Macedonia to India. After Alexander's death, his generals split up his massive empire. Ptolemy and Seleucus both claimed the land of Judea. Ptolemy, in the words of Civil War General Nathan Bedford Forrest, quote-unquote, got there first with the mostest men. I guess he had the greatest force. He had the most boots on the ground, I guess we would say, the most sandals on the ground back those days. His capture of Jerusalem astonished his troops, for they simply marched into the city unopposed since it was the Shabbos. The Jews would not bear arms against them, which is very interesting because actually in the code of Jewish law, Jews are supposed to. So I guess they were just taken so in such a surprise fashion, because the code of Jewish law does allow, for instance, the Jews fought with the Yom Kippur War of 1973. My father-in-law was in Israel. He was in synagogue that day, and all of a sudden, it was an announcement made in the shul. Anyone who can serve in Sahal in the Israeli army should go out to there and call up their bases where my father would serve as a reservist to help in the effort. So it's interesting that Ptolemy was able to do that. It only can be because the hand of God was, you know, empowering them to do so. The soldiers of Ptolemy, quote unquote, made sport of the Jews and called them a foolish people. And that's quoted by Grisel's A History of the Jews, page 43, for not defending their city, thus underlying the Grecian culture's condescending attitude towards the Torah and strengthening the foundations of Greek anti-Semitism. And this is unfortunately a painful axiomatic teaching when people with ill intent against another people observe the weakness of the people they're trying to conquer. They don't have mercy upon them even after they conquer them. They, so to speak, put salt on the wound and are more insulting and more degrading, more condescending. Dennis, any take on these matters?
Yes, the keepers of the faith have had a hard time in the history of the world. Why? Because people say, why do you keep with that old, old stuff? Why don't you just give a little so that we can all live together? But they don't realize that giving a little is giving a lot, and it doesn't help you to keep faith.
Alan?
Yeah, well, that is exactly true, and that's the same message that the Greeks used 2,500 years ago. I will say that it was the takeover of Jerusalem that you just talked about that more than anything led to the rabbinic ruling that you can defend yourself on Shabbat.
Repeat that again, Alan.
Sorry, it was when the Greeks marched into Jerusalem unopposed, that had more than anything else to do with the later rabbinic ruling that you could defend yourself on Shabbat.
Aha. Uh-huh. So that was the antecedent which would lead to the ruling that you would be able to defend yourself, and therefore we can understand why the Jews went out and defended themselves at the beginning of the Yom Kippur War rather than incurring unnecessary damage and collateral damage for that matter.
Because the rabbis say that the Torah is meant to live by, not to die by.
Right. Thank you for that clarification. I didn't know that, and I'm not ashamed to say that that I learned that from Alan right now. Blessed those, we've now come to the conclusion of today's program. You know, we're getting closer to Passover, so yours truly has to kind of vacate early today. I apologize for leaving early. Next week I do hope to do a program, Dennis and Alan, Alan and Dennis. Probably do like a 30-35 minute presentation again as we did today. I'd like to thank both of you for utilizing one of the most valuable of your human resources, your blessed time here. So before we end today's program, Dennis, would you like to share some wisdom with our blessed Blog Talk Radio Soul Class audience that they could continue to be a little more nourished based on what you're about to say?
You can be nourished by reading history as long as you can separate opinion from fact.
Thank you. Alan?
And I will add to that that one must take the opinion of a Greek and Roman viewpoint with a big bag of salt.
Okay, thank you. Okay, blessed souls, it's just little me, Don Zusier Gumin, your local cyberspace Torah activist, Torah Askan, radio talk, blog talk radio host. And
blogger,
we're going to be concluding with, huh?
Blogger, talker, who likes spicy spaghetti.
And you don't forget, I love it with chia.
And later.
And the man who likes spaghetti with chia now has to say, see ya. It's Just Little Me by David Dohm will help us back home to help us realize and internalize our divine image, will help us get up from scrimmage. Our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. And I have to remind you, blessed souls, time and time and time again, because I have to remind myself time and time again, you've got to do good. I've got to do good. We've all got to do good, because it's Teva Tov Lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to do good. And that being said, because the Creator created us, that means we are empowered to do it. In fact, I just saw something yesterday. Rabbi Nachman said, if you're alive in this world, meaning you were born into this world, it means that the world needs you, and the world needs you to improve. Your little microcosmic place in this macrocosmic universe, ever-expanding, ever-growing, ever-flowing, and hopefully this should all be accomplished in the way of a havachad, one of gorlachad, one destiny, kolonim, badachinam, darkishom, a pleasant, peaceful way, lahamshik, vezeshem, yisparech, with the help of the Most High Creator, It's Just a Little Me by David Dohm. Take care, everyone.
Sometimes I'm getting impatient, but I'm still hoping for the best. Working through all my frustrations, can I still be heaven blessed? The powers in my hand, and though I can send my command, and when it gets to my head, try and be humble instead, saying it's all right, it's me, that's how it must be. Fumbling through life like a blind man in a crowd of bumper cars, dodging the bullets from crazy, they haven't got me so far. And though it's beyond my control, all this repairing of the soul, there you are, pulling the string, patiently reading me. Oh Lord, it's all right, it's me, it's how it has to be. Lately, blowing me to the side. But oh, it feels like you need. And oh, I'm so glad that you're here. Without you, what will I be? With you, I'm just little me.